Yeah, I really enjoyed the book. Oh, well,
thanks.
What kind of name is Chakotis?
It's Lithuanian. I'm 100% Lithuanian.
Really?
Yeah.
Chakotis.
Chakotis. Yeah.
I interviewed a guy who's also 100% Lithuanian, Vito Palakarkis.
With an IS on the end of it, that usually nails him down as Lithuanian.
Yeah.
Like Dick Butkus or U.S.
Yeah, he was involved.
Like
he was greatly involved in the Lithuanian church here, and he was a book writer. Lives on Staten Island.
I was given a reading in Atlanta, and somebody remarked about something that led me to answer about my ethnic background, and I said, and I'm sure most of you don't even know where Lithuania is, and about 12 people in the audience raised their hands and said, what are you talking about? We're Lithuanian. It shocked me, and Stanley Kunitz is half Lithuanian, Czesław Miłosz, Joseph Brodsky, they're all Litwaks too.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me that there might be more Lithuanians in the United States than in Lithuania.
Yeah, right.
That's true. I think New York has more Spanish-speaking people than Madrid.
Right, right.
Or Havana.
Chicago has a huge Lithuanian population, 1.2 million or something like that, a Lithuanian museum, and I'm sure they have a Lithuanian liberation movement somewhere.
Have you ever tried to explore your cultural background?
Well, it's not easy. My parents are a little foggy about it. My mother's parents died before I was born, and my grandfather died when I was a small child, so it was only my fraternal grandmother who I ever met. And I don't know much about it. It's peasant stock. We were serfs, I'm sure. And
we all were.
Yeah, right. My great-grandfather was a gameskeeper for the Russian gentry, I guess. And the children immigrated during the last czarist conscription drive. Great-grandfather sent all of his children overseas, one way or the other.
Well, you have some line on your background.
Yeah, and beyond that, there's nothing. I do know that one of my great uncles was General Shukov in the Russian army. He was like the Eisenhower of the Russian forces during World War II. I remember with my father working for the government that we could never say that. That was supposed to be information that we simply did not know anything about.
Now, I'm kind of like you. I don't have contact with my roots at all, and I always made the assumption that I came from my relatives came from our ancestors came from England.
Yeah,
Swaim is an English type name, and then I got a letter in the mail about 2 weeks ago from some guy in New Jersey who doesn't have my last name, but is supposed to be part of a branch of my family.
Yeah,
and he claims that the family originated in Holland.
No kidding.
Beats me. I mean, maybe we came over on the Mayflower.
Yeah. So. Well, my wife's family is the first family of Virginia, and in fact, there's a story in this book that's more or less about her uncle, a story called Where Pelham Fell. And he died shortly after that. I finished that story. My wife and I have different last names. They never told him my last name. They just kept that information from him because he would have been outraged by that penetration of the foreign element into the family.
The foreign element corrupting the blood.
Yeah.
Blood of Virginia.
Absolutely.
Where were you born?
Pittston, Pennsylvania. My grandfather was a coal miner in the coal fields up there, and he died of black lung disease. And moved at the age of 2 to Washington, D.C., where my father was in the civil service with the Navy for 30 years.
You have kind of a southern drawl.
Especially after drinking a little bit. But I consider myself a Virginian. I haven't really lived there since I went away to college. Of course, my wife's family, they barely consider me an American. Mm-hmm. Being centuries old Virginia stock.
Where do you live now?
Tallahassee, Florida.
Are you teaching there?
No, my wife's going to law school. Mm-hmm. And I'm just there trying to hustle a living as a writer. Mm-hmm. I was just teaching at Wichita State for the semester as a visiting writer in residence and in
Kansas?
And in
Wichita?
Yeah.
Place of my birth.
Is it really?
That's right.
Well, I liked Wichita.
What's it like? I haven't been there since I was two.
It's the biggest city in Kansas. It's the air capital of the world. It's the ritual murder capital of America.
The what?
Ritual murder capital of America.
What's that?
They have more ritual murders, their satanic cult murders, than anywhere
else. Oh,
come on. No, I'm serious.
Wichita, Kansas.
I'm serious. It's amazed me, too. And it's very neighborhoodish and has a downtown that needs to be revitalized. But I loved it. Great. It's like being on a set piece for the 1950s. Great cafes, old-time Art Deco cafes and great nightclubs, and Wichita State University is one of the biggest universities in Kansas, and it was nice. I like the Midwest. I like the people in the Midwest.
Is Wichita run down at all?
Yeah, the downtown area is. But most of it's suburban, and it's the sort of suburbs where people remark, what a wonderful place to raise your kids. I like Midwestern people. I don't like the Midwest. I love Midwestern people. They're the nicest people in America.
I got a jolt sometime. I was interviewing Jim Lehrer of the McNeil Air Report, and it turns out he was born in Wichita, Kansas. And, in fact, he was born in Wesley Memorial Hospital, where I was born.
No kidding.
We were born 3 years apart.
That's great.
Same hospital.
That's great. A lot of, who else is from Wichita? Who are the new generation? Kirstie Alley's from Wichita.
Who?
The woman on Cheers, the dark-haired woman on the television show Cheers.
I've missed that show.
She's just one of the new generation of
There is a writer
actresses.
That I read, he wrote a book, title of which escapes me.
James Lee Burke is in Wichita. He's a mystery detective novelist who just finally hit the bullseye with his newest novel, which he sold for $250,000. Henry Holt's putting it out in the fall, and we'll push it. We'll try to make it, get him on the bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
I took his job. He was on a Guggenheim for the semester. Albert Goldbarth is a poet, essayist, who teaches at Wichita. Other than that, I don't know who else the writers are.
Well, there's a writer that I ran across named Lawrence Swaim.
Swaim?
Spelled the same way I spell my name, and he lives in San Francisco. He wrote a book about a postal strike in San Francisco a few years ago, and I happened just to run across the book in a secondhand bookshop, and I bought it. It wasn't a bad...
Is he a cousin of yours,
Wichitan? No, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it's spelled the same, and we're from the same city, but I have no relatives in Wichita.
Yeah. He's probably in San Francisco saying the same thing.
Yeah.
He has no relatives in Wichita. But
I always meant to drop him a note and tell him I had read his book, and we shared the same hometown and the same name, but I never got around to it.
I bet somewhere there that your blood crosses, it must.
It's
too much of a coincidence.
Well, as you were growing up in Pennsylvania.
No, in Virginia is where
actually.
I grew up. Yeah, we left Pennsylvania when I was 2 years old.
I see.
Yeah.
Where in Virginia were you growing up?
McLean. Are you familiar with the Washington metro area? It's just right across the river from D.C.
Oh, yeah.
The CIA is in McLean. The Kennedys.
You said your father was a bureaucrat.
Yeah, he worked for the Navy. He was something like the assistant director for the Bureau of Navy Personnel,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Sounds important.
I have no idea.
Because all government jobs sound important.
Yeah, right.
You grew up in a literary household?
Not at all. I grew up in a household that was, my parents were first-generation American, and they came out of the coal fields of Pennsylvania, and really they were nouveau middle class. And the Bobbsey twins and the Hardy Boys were always around, but in no way was it a literary household. Still isn't a literary household.
Well, I used to think I grew up with the great books because my father subscribed to the Reader's Digest condensed books. That's what we had around the house.
Right, we have that too.
Stringently edit these Reader's Digest condensed books. I mean, they don't just condense them. I mean, they take out anything
that is
offensive.
A little bit off color.
Yeah, anything. I mean, and they really do a number on these.
They're
proud of it. The books read smoothly. But,
sure.
And they're very selective, too.
And they're good to grow up on, but after you grow up you should probably leave them behind.
Absolutely. Where did you go on to college?
I went to journalism school at the University of Missouri and graduated in 1973, and then left the country for 5 years on and off. Three years on and off, and came back in 77 and went to school again at the University of Missouri, got a master's degree in English, worked on a newspaper in Palm Beach for a year, and then went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1980. Graduated in 82, lived in San Francisco for a year, finishing Easy in the Islands and doing some journalism. Then we lived in Charlottesville, Virginia for a year, then 2 years back in Missouri where my wife was teaching, and I taught 1 year there, and then I taught at Iowa 85 to 86. And then what the hell did we do? I won the book award, and we had enough money to go to the Outer Banks of North Carolina for a year, and which is a dream come true because it was where I always used to go as a child on vacations. So we went to the beach. And that was up to a year and a half ago, and then my wife entered law school, so we've been in Tallahassee since then.
Did you ever run across a young writer named, I think his name is David Payne, on the Outer Banks?
Yeah, I know about David Payne. We've never met, but I sure know about him. I'm waiting to meet him.
He's an engaging young man.
Yeah.
And his family had a little summer place, and fixed it up, so he lived there year-round and worked on his...
He had a big, fat book, didn't
huge
he?
Book. Yeah. What was it called? Confessions of a Taoist Stockbroker.
Right. An amazing sort of book for somebody to write on the Outer Banks. And
a huge book, too. His first effort, his first writing.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad, and it got a lot of... It had a number of good reviews.
Yeah.
It was awkward in some spots. It was really too big. And I did talk to his editor, who said he was a little difficult to work with because he just didn't want to cut.
Yeah, obviously, if he's writing a big, fat book, he's a man who loves...
His words.
Loves the weight.
Likes the weight.
Yeah.
He would have benefited by a more stringent editing job. The book would have been better.
Yeah.
You do make, to write a huge book like that, you do make demands on the reader, and some readers balk at it.
I know, I understand, and from the writer's point of view, I understand how you get trapped into writing a large book, a book that goes on page after page after page. I feel like I'm working on a novel that will probably clock in at 800 or 900 pages. I hate that idea. I don't want it to be that way. It's not something that you've feel totally in control of, and you really depend on an editor to save you, pull you out of the mire if you can't do it yourself. Of course, see, I feel that I've done it myself because the compulsion is that, or the thinking is that, well, if I just didn't control myself better, it'd be a 1,500-page book, and I got it down to 900 pages, and with somebody else, a good editor, could take it down probably to 500 or 400 pages.
I was talking to Elie Wiesel, his first book was called Night. It was a memoir. And it was a book that ran 140 pages, and he reduced it from a more than 800-page manuscript.
Amazing. Did he do that all himself, or did he have some collaboration with an editor?
Well, he... influential person for him was Primo Levi.
Yeah.
Who committed suicide 2 years
right.
ago. And... So I think there was some collaboration with people who were helping him. He was also a journalist, wrote in French.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was an exercise in excising, so to speak.
And in community, too. If Levy was in there helping him, and perhaps an editor, a book ends up being a community of experience, or the process of it draws in a community, your wife, your friends, the people you trust the most, and of course your editor. And
isn't it true a writer in the middle of his work can look at it and just, I can't tell where I am?
I have no idea where I am. I feel like I've been living in a cave in the dark with a beast that I don't know what the beast looks like, and I have to get past the beast to get out of the cave, and I haven't any idea how to do that. And Russell Banks just finished his newest novel and wrote me a letter saying it was like living with an ugly, depressed person for 2.5 years. So, and whatever struggle you go through, I can't believe anybody who says they enjoy it and it's, the lights are always shining. But apparently, clearly, novelists do, prolific novelists do, since they don't seem to struggle. But I've never written a novel before. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I threw away 500 pages, 3 years of work, a year and a half ago because I had never heard the voice of the novel.
And yet, many of the stories in The Next New World
They're long.
Some of them are novella length.
Right.
you could have expanded these if you'd wished and explored other characters.
I wish that I wished, because then I would have, instead of a collection of eight long stories, maybe I could have eight short novels. and that would be better for a lot of reasons, and I would get a monkey off my back, a feeling that I have to write a novel.
But you don't have to write a novel. Now, I was talking to Raymond Carver sometime before his death.
Yeah, Ray never wrote.
And everybody had pushed him to write a novel, and he sat there right where you're sitting, and he said, you know, I may never write a novel, and you know something? It's all right if I don't.
Yeah, well, I'm not mature enough yet to know that. I certainly wouldn't kill myself, but there still is a pressure in the air that you're not a grown-up writer until you write that novel. And, of course, that's ridiculous, but I understand it, at least from my point of view right now in the middle of my first novel. A novel is takes such enormous strength and breadth of vision to write. To me, it was like building a skyscraper, and because the short stories have come rather easily, in a way, right now they seem like pitching tents compared to building skyscrapers. So it's very, very hard. Or, flash in the pan affairs compared to a marriage where the responsibility goes is endless and it takes a lot more patience. Those are just the in-process feelings. I know that if I don't write a novel, my life won't be quite happy. But I bought in a little bit to the notion that the novel is the superior form, or the more challenging form. And, of course, there are plenty of novelists, highly successful novelists, who think that they couldn't write a successful short story if their lives depended on it.
Well, now, they're different. With a novel, you can't make the novel as intricate as you can make your short stories. A short story, there's a parallel. A poem, for example, should be should be as perfect a piece of work as possible. All the imagery should be correct.
Yeah.
A novel, you can't do it. I mean, I don't think anybody can sustain himself in poetic form in a novel. While some novels read brilliantly, there are usually flaws in them. There are digressions. There are scenes that probably should have been cut or added, or characters expanded, and the language could have been tighter. But you can get away with it, especially the longer the novel, you get away with more of it.
I hear you can get away with it. For instance, Michiko Kakutani reviewed Salman Rushdie's new book today, and she didn't let him get away with it for a second.
Well, she's tough.
Yeah.
She's murdered books that I thought were sensational.
Yeah. Well, I survived her, I guess, 2 weeks ago is when she reviewed this book, and I survived her without too many cuts. I came out still able to breathe and have the blood supply I went in there with.
Well, tell me about your first book, Easy in the Islands. It won the American Book Award. That must have been
a bolt
really
of
something,
lightning.
A new writer and first book?
Yeah, a bolt of lightning. Well, it won the... It killed the award it won, because that was the last time that the American Book Awards gave an award for first fiction, and that was also the year where they became, as an awards nonprofit institution, became solvent again after the bankruptcy of the National Book Awards in the late 70s, and decided, well, now we're going to switch back to our former name, the National Book Awards, and only to make the awards more prestigious than ever, just have two, one for nonfiction and one for fiction. So I was certainly lucky. I killed the Playboy's Best New Contributing Writer Awards, too. I was the last one to win that award before they shut it down.
It was funny, the American Book Awards, where they were, I think they had awards for Best Book Design and dust jackets.
I think they had 28 awards.
It was kind of fun, though, in a way.
It was a circus, but it did
take the edge off of the big mm-hmm. winners, the nonfiction winner and the fiction winners.
And more than anything, they ran out of money doing that.
Yeah.
They became bankrupt.
Yeah, and publishing is a kind of a funny business anyway. I mean, I think economically they play it closer to the vest, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. Well, writers have a tendency to do that anyway, so well, people in general do. It's never worried me what I was making because I never made anything in terms of money. But everybody is tight-lipped about it. My agent's so tight-lipped I don't even know who our client list is. And it's protecting the privacy of other people. I understand that. But
a short story writer, it does seem difficult. How does a short story writer... Well, he can't survive on short stories, can he, really?
Easier than writing a novel, because conceivably you can do a story a month, and if they have...
Yeah, but how much would the new Virginia Review...
$200. But then again, on the other hand, on the other side of it, Playboy pays $5,000 mm-hmm. starting in 1989 for their stories. And
and how many stories did they publish a year? It comes out a month, what, two, three stories at most in each issue?
Yeah, I think they would publish probably two or three stories of mine a year if I could supply them with that. So that's $15,000. But, and that's more than I've made on a book.
I think most people who write and most people in publishing say that we're talking about art, and it's true. There are some people who, I imagine, Tom Wolfe has to be a millionaire with Bonfire of the Vanities.
Oh, sure.
I mean,
he was a millionaire before.
Even before, yeah. Right. He's got a townhouse in Manhattan.
Sure.
But, I mean, that is a rarity. The vast majority of writers that I interview, and I do several interviews a week, usually supplement their art by other jobs.
I do journalism.
Yeah.
I work for Harper's. I've got a column with GQ, a dining-in column. I talk about cooking. I do, and I teach.
Is that right? I was just reading GQ. I have it. Matter of fact, I have it out in the newsroom. I didn't know you had contributed.
It just started. The column started in with the December issue.
On cooking?
Yeah, it's called Dining In, and domestic anecdotes. That the only requirement is that the end of the column has to have a recipe at it. So I talk about living at home with the dog and doing the grocery shopping and cooking for my wife who's in law school.
Oh,
I like doing it.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get that magazine. I haven't finished it yet. I'll start that. Well, tell me about the stories in the next New World. And one thing that struck me about all of these stories is that every one of them is different.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking for some sort of unifying theme, but I couldn't find one.
They're unifying images. Well, the next New World, the idea of a next New World to me is... the book's dedicated to two of my best friends who died in the past year, and the next New World is, in a way, in the stories and in the way I think about the book, a metaphor for death. But it's not an unhappy book. But yeah, all the stories are different, I've had some anxiety about that. People would either say, "My God, look at the range, the diversity! Isn't that marvelous that he can do so many things? He's sort of like a Robin Williams. He's got all the voices in his head that have to come out." Or they would say, "Geez, there's no consistency here. Who is this guy? He doesn't know who he is. He's one thing one minute, one thing the next, and then a third thing, and then a fourth thing. There, you can't pin him down." And I don't know how to react to a criticism like that.
If there is a criticism like that, I'm not sure there is.
Yeah, I'm not sure there is either, but it's certainly how I respond to the book myself.
But I believe there is death in each of the stories, except I believe the one that's set in Rehoboth.
Yeah, and there's a sense of loss.
A sense of loss, yes.
And fading.
Some of the stories...
And ghosts.
Some of the stories are set in the Caribbean, apparently.
Two. And those are both the newest stories in the book. And I can't tell you why, except that they're just stories that and were written around images or sentences that captured my imagination. And I was back in the Caribbean again. But I'm trying to write less about the Caribbean.
Why?
Well, my novel is going to be half about the Caribbean and half about Virginia, set in both locations, and that's enough. I don't want to be known as a person who can only write about the Caribbean.
I want like two stories about the Caribbean in here.
I know, but it's packaged as if it were another Caribbean book. I just want to feel free to do whatever I want without having to say, well, what's he doing that for? He's the guy who writes about the Caribbean. What's he doing writing about Michigan? He doesn't belong there.
You went all over the world, all over the United States. You could write about anything you want, can't you?
Oh, yeah. Free world.
No, I like that idea of, because there were places that I've been to, like Rehoboth. It was nice seeing these, it was nice going from place to place with you in these books. When you start to write the story, is it pretty well written in your mind, or do you sit at the word processor or typewriter and then start?
Yeah, it's an exploration. At least there's some foundation that I can work forward to or work backwards from, whether it's an ending or there's some narrative logic going, but I don't know it any more than I know the future, what's going to happen. In my life for the next week, I have an idea how things will be, but certainly anything could happen. And a lot of the stories gear off events, and a lot of the stories are, for me, acts of witnessing rather than acts of the imagination. Sometimes I feel that imagination is a dirty word in contemporary American literature, and when you have it, you're either exotic or you're contrived or you're undisciplined, or you have nothing to say that really seriously relates to contemporary American life. And I just, in my own life, too many phenomenal things happened, or at least I witnessed things that are marvelous or fantastic. And they're not acts of the imagination, although they seem to be acts of the imagination to other people.
Yeah, so there is, you said, your writing as a witness. So these are not just spontaneous stories. I mean, they have to develop from some observation.
Sure.
Some
There's form. A story in the middle of the book called Celebrations of the New World, and it's about a family reunion with a Anglo side of the family gets together with a Lebanese side of the family.
In Philadelphia.
The only thing, really, and there's a Mexican uncle who comes in just for the occasion, who is the only thing really made up in that story is the setting. The setting was really St. Louis, and it's the story of a family trauma, a tragedy, that took place in the life of one of my best friends. The woman and the man, all the people in there are real to some extent, and the event is real. And it sounds, because of such a rich, exotic mix of people, Lebanese and Mexican and a Trotskyite and bureaucrats and all, it sounds a little fantastical, but it's really not. It's just life as I know it in America, which is, in a way, more of an immigrant life than an Upper East Side life.
You mentioned that you're working on a novel now. Are you finding the transition to this longer form difficult?
Excruciatingly difficult. An editor told me, a magazine editor who buys my short stories, told me when I began the novel to just write it as if it were a sequence of short stories. It would be very easy to write the novel. Richard Price told me when we were at Yaddo together to just go ahead, just get the beginning nailed down and then go ahead and do whatever you want. It's just the greatest sense of freedom in the world, and I found both those bits of advice to be entirely useless for me. I couldn't write it as if it were each chapter as if they were short stories. I wish that I could, because it seems like it would be a great release and relief.
You write the way it comes to you.
Right.
I mean, nobody can establish a pattern for somebody else's work.
Right. And I wasn't one of those young writers who wrote two or three novels in their 20s. I didn't have a novel on the shelf when I was 22 years old or 26 years old or 29 years old. It wasn't until I was 30 that I began working on this book, and I had an apprenticeship to go through, I suppose, because the first 500 pages were a mess, and they had to be thrown out, and I had to start over again, and I feel comfortable with what's going on now. I still don't know what I'm doing.
Well, art is a process of exploration.
It's got to be, I guess, and discovery. I'm not always sure what the process is except lifestyle. I know that it allows me to live a life, the style of life that I desire, and allows me to produce what interests me. Other than that, I'm not sure for the artist what art is. I've got moral standards and aesthetic values. What they have to do with my work, I'm not sure. Somebody else might be able to tell me, or maybe I'll formulate those ideas in my head in a more lucid way as I grow older. Right now, it's just building a house for an image that has attracted me, or a line that I would like to live somewhere, or simply to tell a story of something odd that I saw take place in the world. For instance, the title story in Easing the Islands, reviewers who didn't especially like that book started there with that story and said, this is so contrived. And it, for me, it might as well have been a piece of journalism, because it was just a story about a real friend of mine who ran a hotel in the Caribbean when I was a Peace Corps volunteer there. His mother did come to visit him. Out of nowhere, he hadn't seen her for a long time. She was there 2 days, and she died. And he wouldn't allow the local authorities to perform an autopsy on her. He wanted the autopsy done in the States. They said, why are you resisting this notion of an autopsy? You probably killed her, didn't you? And it went on from there. You had to put the body in the hotel freezer, and eventually it resolved itself differently than my story resolves itself, where they toss her body out of the airplane into the ocean. But more or less, just again witnessing the world.
Yeah. Well, there are two. I have two things to respond. One, you talk about contrivance. Often there's a criticism in literature about an author using coincidence, and so most writers try to avoid using coincidence, and yet. I was reading somewhere, I can't remember exactly where, it was in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. I think there was an article about this very subject. And it said, coincidence happens in real life all the time.
Absolutely.
And like in your short story, you write it exactly the way it happened. Or they might say, well, that's contrived.
Right.
He uses coincidence.
Right.
But actually, coincidence happens. For example, you and I had a coincidence. You taught in Wichita,
right.
And I was born in Wichita.
Right. Leaving the town of Wichita on December 15th to go on my holidays. I hate to sound so voodoo-oriented here. It's not voodoo, but there's some mysticism. Whenever you talk coincidence, you talk about some higher force in the universe. I don't want to talk about a higher force. I just want to talk about coincidence. I had a little adorno, which is a figurine from a pre-Columbian pot that I found in a dig down in the islands. And I, in an act of friendship to somebody who had been nice to me all semester long, I said, I want to give you this as a going-away present. And it thoughtlessly said, because I had never thought this before, but this is my good luck, and I want you to tell me that I'm not giving away my good luck to you. And the person didn't answer me. He just sort of smiled and said, thanks for the present. The next month turned out to be the worst month of my life that I know of. We got snowed in the mountains of Utah, had to be rescued. Our dog, who we loved the way a childless couple loves a pet, you give them the emotional investment you would give your child. Our dog died. Everything's been miserable since I gave that away, and I called the guy back up and said, you have to FedEx that little figurine back to me. And the day it arrived is the day that I got a good review in Time magazine, and my good luck started coming back to me. The day my dog died was also exactly a year after the person who the book is dedicated to died, who was the person who took care of our dog when we went out of the country and things like that. Those things permeate, incidents like that, coincidences like that, permeate my life. There's no way I can't write about the world through my vision and my experience and my sensibilities without coincidence being a major narrative and realistic trigger.
Of course, you risked criticism, but I have the other thing I wanted to say about that was that criticism is only an opinion.
Yeah.
Someone else's opinion. It has no necessary validity. It's only an opinion. And you know, one of the ways you can prove it is that great books, many great books that had been turned down by editors, by agents, dozen times, two dozen times, will often turn out to be bestsellers and critically acclaimed. Now, why? Somebody said, well, this book is no good.
Right.
That was an opinion.
Ironweed
is a prime example of that. Bob, I know you have other appointments, and I do too. I think the stories in The Next New World were absolutely terrific. I'm going to look forward to reading other of your stories, and certainly your novel.
Someday.
If and when that is pulled off, and I have no doubt that you'll be able to do it. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Dr.